So thanks to Ben and Kevin for giving me a chance to speak here. So I've prepared a sort of non-specialist talk, just to make it a bit more general. I realize that there are people here from different backgrounds. So let me just give some words of introduction to sort of set the kind of more specialized stage for what I want to talk about here. So I'm going to talk just very broadly. The talk is about looking at certain problems in combinatorics and their connections with various problems in physics. So there are well-known examples of this in various branches, gauge theory, statistical mechanics, and also in mathematics, algebraic geometry, infinite representation theory of infinite dimensional algebras, topology, and so on. So in this talk, what I'm going to particularly focus on are the type of combinatorial problems that come up in supersymmetric gauge theories in even dimensions. So in these four even dimensionalities, and I'm going to sort of summarize what these problems are through the viewpoint of instanton counting in supersymmetric gauge theories. So let me just give the sort of the stage for why people have been thinking about this in recent years. So if we go to the case of six dimensions, the counting problems have been studied for a long time. And by now, they're well understood. So from the string theory perspective, one's interested in counting BPS states of D-brains in two-way string theory on a toric Calabi-Yau threefold. And these are related to the counting of configurations of certain models in statistical mechanics called molten crystals. From a gauge theory perspective, these are related to instanton countings in the six-dimensional cohomological gauge theories on a Calabi-Yau threefold. And then ultimately in algebraic geometry, these are connected to computing the Donaldson-Thomas invariants of X, which are invariants that give kind of virtual counts of sheaves on your threefold. Okay, so I'm going through this mostly because I want to also put up the relevant references, because in the main part of the talk I'm going to be a bit slack with quoting references along. So that's the well-known case for D equals 3. And so the next thing you can ask is what happens in D equals 4. And until the last few years, the generalizations to D equals 4 were not well understood. So if what's happened recently, going back to about 7 years or so, is if you have a toric Calabi-Yau fourfold X, what has been understood? What are the recent developments? Well, in algebraic geometry, it's been understood how to calculate virtual cycles for the moduli spaces of sheaves on X, okay, which is needed to define Donaldson-Thomas invariants. Starting from this work of Nekrasov, it's been understood how to relate this to the instanton counting in an eight-dimensional cohomological gauge theory. And then there's been subsequent developments now in using these techniques to calculate the Donaldson-Thomas theory of a toric Calabi-Yau fourfold. And more recently, the crystal models, the melting crystal models for computing BPS bound states of D-brains on X have also been understood. So this is the sort of progress that's been made recently, and this sort of sets the stage for why we're sort of interested in these counting problems and what they have to do with each other. So these are the modern problems. From the gauge theory perspective, instanton counting, there are lower dimensional predecessors of these theories. So these are the n equals 2 gauge theories in four dimensions. And also by certain dimensional reduction techniques, they're related to vortex counting in supersymmetric gauge theories in two dimensions. So the goal of this talk is I'm going to give a very broad brush overview, a non-technical overview that hopefully bits and pieces different people get in the audience get out of it. And just to compare the different developments in the various dimensionalities from the different perspectives, and sort of see the hierarchy of what complications occur here. Okay? So most of what I say today is not going to be anything new to the experts, so I'm not going to announce any new results or say anything that the experts don't already know. But hopefully this gives there's a nice story that develops here and gives some idea of what these new developments are. Okay, so I'm following a review paper that I wrote with my PhD student, Michelangelo Torelli, a couple of years ago, where this is all spelled out in a bit more detail. So the outline for the rest of the talk, I'm going to start from the simplest point of view, and that's combinatorics. So we're going to go and look at the counting problems, and these are problems for enumerating things called partitions. Okay, so I'll go through and discuss what's known there, and then ultimately what are the challenges in these combinatorial problems. And then I'm going to switch to some physics, some gauge theory, look at generalized instanton equations, and in particular look at moduli spaces of solutions to these equations. Okay, and then looking at the geometry of these moduli spaces, which defines the instanton counting problem, are going to feed into the combinatorial problems and tell us something about why there are difficulties from a combinatorist's point of view in these counting problems, and potentially how to deal with them. Okay, and so ultimately the last part of the talk is also related to the enumerative geometry of these folds in various dimensions, although I'll mostly talk about it from a very basic point of view. Okay, so there's not going to be a lot of technical details in the talk. Okay, so let's start with the combinatorial problem. So what is the simplest thing we can think of counting in this certain context? Well, we can just count some objects that have no detail to them. So just simply objects, and all we care about is how many of these objects there are in a given configuration. Okay, so we can start with the empty set, which has no configurations, then we can have one object, two, and so on. And we label them by this integer n. And of course, so there's only one object for each such configuration. We're going to weigh those by some variable, which will, if you aren't worried about convergence, you assume it's a complex number of modulus 1, less than 1. And as usual in these problems, you encode all the counts into some generating function. Okay, so we introduce this generating function, which in this case, the generating function for these numbers p1 is, of course, very simple. And the name of the game in combinatorics is, of course, to find closed expressions for these generating functions. So this generating function is, of course, known to any first-year undergrad. It's just the geometric series. And I tried to look at the history of who first wrote down the geometric series, and I couldn't find really a clear answer. So Euclid comes up first in the list, because apparently he's the first one who wrote the formula for the finite geometric progression, right? But of course, he didn't know calculus, so he wouldn't have known about taking the limits. But anyway, so I'll say it's sort of due to Euclid. Okay, so just to introduce some further terminology, these generating functions are conveniently written in terms of things called plethysmic exponentials of simpler functions. And from a physicist's point of view, what you want to think of the generating function as some grand canonical partition function of some statistical mechanics system. And then these plethysmic exponentials, their arguments will be the one particle partition function. So what is that? So if you have an analytic function with this power series that vanishes at zero, then the plethysmic exponential is defined by this formula here. Okay, and it's just an elementary computation you can do by taking logs of both sides to show that that's the same as this infinite product here. Or you can invert the plethysmic exponential using Mobius inversion to get something called the plethysmic logarithm and reinterpret your single particle partition function as a plethysmic logarithm of some infinite product. And so for the geometric series, this is quite easy. The plethysmic log is just this function q. And that's what you expect for a single particle wave partition function in this case. And so there's nothing deep here, nothing deep, but I've just used this to introduce the type of things we want to think about for more complicated problems. So that's d equals 1. We go to the next level, d equals 2. And now we don't just want to look at collections of objects, but we want to look at how these objects are each composed of more elementary constituents. Okay, so in other words, we want to count partitions. So the number of ways of representing a natural number as a sum of other natural numbers. And up to permutations of the sumands, we don't care what order they appear in the sum, so we want to count, give them some ordering, so we count these ordered partitions. Their size, we'll use this symbol, this kind of absolute value symbol. And of course, what is well known to most people is that partitions correspond to Young diagrams that you write in the two-dimensional lattice, where the prescription is that in the ith row of this diagram, you place lambda I squares. Okay, so here's a very easy example for n equals 12. If you take this partition, you put 5 squares in the first row, 3 in the second, and so on. It's a pictorial way to represent partitions. Okay, so again, we want to count these things. So we introduce a generating function of all these numbers, p2 of n. And this series was summed by Euler. He gives this famous product, infinite product formula. And the plethysmic logarithm of the generating function is, again, some very simple function, okay, which has this power series. So the power series expansion matches with the formulas I gave on the previous slide. And the formula, Euler's formula, is useful for various things. For instance, there's a modularity a property that looks like this under inversion of this this number tau, and that allows you to extract the behavior of these numbers asymptotically to a very good accuracy. So that was one of the uses of the formula, why combinatorists are interested in these things. Okay, so that's the other well-known thing. Now we continue. We start making the problem more complicated. So now what we do is we start taking these partitions, these two-dimensional Young diagrams, we start stacking them into three-dimensional things called plane partitions. So a plane partition of an integer now is a two-dimensional array of natural numbers, which also satisfies some decreasing condition as you go along either direction of the array. Again, there's a pictorial representation of plane partitions given in terms of three-dimensional Young diagrams now. So if you pile a number of boxes or cubes at position ij0 in this kind of xy plane, it gives you this picture. So I mentioned this melting crystal model. You can think of these plane partitions in terms of what's called the melting crystal model. So you imagine you have this cube here. The boxes are atoms, and you start heating the corner of it, so atoms start evaporating. And the atoms evaporate according to some prescribed rule, which is written down here. And every time an atom is removed by evaporating, you take the box and you stack it in the corner of the room. You start building up these configurations. So that's the melting crystal model. And so, again, we want to count these configurations, and every time you remove an atom from the corner of the crystal, you count that with the Boltzmann weight given by this parameter Q. Okay, so now again, we just do the same thing we did before. We let the number of plane partitions of a given size, which is the total number of boxes in your three-dimensional Young diagram, and you define a generating function again for them. And you ask, does this generating function have a closed form? And it does. It was summed by McMahon. You get this infinite product formula, again, which looks almost like the Euler function, except there's this extra power of n there. And again, the platistic logarithm of this function is very simple. It's given by q over 1 minus q squared, which has this power series expansion. So these are combinatorial problems and their solutions. So there, just to say, make a couple of comments about this case. There are various extensions of it that you can define. You can define more complicated statistical mechanical models now. So if you have a trivalent planar graph gamma, you decorate this graph in a certain way. At each trivalent vertex, you place a plane partition. And on each edge of the graph, you put an ordinary partition. On each internal edge, there will be some non-trivial partition, but on the external edges of your graph, you always put the empty, the trivial partition. Okay, and then you define a generating function now. You introduce some extra weights because you don't just want to weight the vertices. You want to also weight these internal edges. And you write down this generating function here. Okay, and this generating function is defined by this formula, and it's a generating function for plane partitions with boundaries. So these are not like the finite plane partitions I wrote down before. These partitions have infinitely many boxes, but they asymptote to two-dimensional partitions. Okay, so you have to give a meaning what you mean by a box count in this case, and that can be done. I'm not going to go through details. And people who know topological string theory or Donaldson-Thomas theory know this. This is just the partition function for a toric Calabi-Yau threefold, and gamma is, of course, the toric graph of that. Okay, but again, it's an interesting combinatorial problem, and it's computable. You can write down closed formulas. So if we look at the simplest trivalent graph, okay, this is just the generating function I wrote down before, right? Because I just put the trivial two-dimensional partitions on the external leg. So I just get back the counting function before. The next thing you could look at is you can think of blowing up the single vertex to two vertices with an internal line. So this gives you this generating function in the first line, where lambda weighs that single internal edge. And you use the formulas that I just wrote down. So you can rearrange that into these sums over pairs of plane partitions. And the sum can be performed. Again, you get a closed generating function involving G3 that I wrote down before, and now a slight modification of G3, which is a function that counts weighted plane partitions. There are other interesting statistical mechanical models that can be written down in this formalism. Okay, so that's d equals 3. Now let's come to the next level is let's go to d equals 4, next level. So now we take our plane partitions and we stack them again in some way to form things that are now called solid partitions of integers. So you just generalize what we did before. Now we've got array of natural numbers that have three indices now. And these natural numbers obey some decreasing condition in each of the three directions. So again, you can give a kind of stacking rule and represent these in terms of four-dimensional Young diagrams. And I can't draw any pictures for that. And there's also a four-dimensional melting crystal model for these things. Okay, so formally, the statistical mechanical problem, or the combinatorial problem, is formally identical to what we discussed before. So you can take now the definition of the generating function for these. And what McMahon did is based on the evidence we have so far for lower values of D, he conjectured this formula. Okay? And this formula just follows because if you compute the plethysmic logarithm of that formula, you get this q over 1 minus q cubed. And if you've been paying attention to the plethysmic log so far, this is the pattern that emerged, right? So D, it's the general pattern is it's q over 1 minus q to the d minus 1. That's what happened for d equals 1, 2, and 3. So the natural thing is to assume that holds for d equals 4. That's what McMahon did. And that guess is famously incorrect. It's famously incorrect. And it took some time to realize that the conjecture is wrong. Because at the time it was conjectured, which is the beginning of the 1900s, there wasn't computer technology to sort of go and calculate these things. So, but if you calculate this to the lower orders, you find it is correct. It does count the correct number of solid partitions. And it's an order q to the sixth. So the solid partitions of six is where it breaks down. So
how big is that coefficient?
Just going to say, so this formula tells you that there are 141 solid partitions, and the actual number is 140. Okay. So it overcounts it by one, but of course that gets worse as you go to higher orders. Okay. So there are 140 solid partitions at order six. And that's not all. So nowadays, of course, we can calculate this the actual generating function to very high orders, and you could look at the plethysmic logarithm. And that starts to have an unusual behavior as well. Okay, so the coefficients in the expansion of the actual plethysmic logarithm start to become non-monotonic. So before they were always increasing, the coefficients. So here they start becoming non-monotonic at order 13, and in fact they start to become negative at order q to the 15. So physically that means that the plethysmic log of the actual generating function does not have some physical interpretation as a single particle partition function. And more precisely, it really means that there is no way that this generating function can have a simple infinite product form like it does in the other cases. Okay, so that's the open problem in combinatorics is what, how do we count solid partitions? And the problem was actually clarified nicely in a recent paper by Nekrasov from 6 years ago, who looked at this problem through the lens of instanton moduli spaces. Okay, we'll come to that later on. But the problem that came out of the way Nekrasov thought about the problem is that this generating function I wrote there, and I called naive, is not the right thing to use. It's not the thing that naturally enumerates solid partitions. So using this work, the idea is to not just sum over q to the powers of the number of cubes in your solid partition, but to put some non-trivial measure in front of there, then sum that quantity. And once you do that, you can get a closed formula for the generating function of solid partitions, whose plethysmic logarithm has a physically meaningful interpretation as a single particle partition function. So that's what I want to explain in the rest of the talk, is how geometry, and in particular the geometry of instantons in gauge theories, provides some insight or clarification into these otherwise unrelated combinatorial problems. Okay, so let's talk a bit about what we mean by instantons here. So I look at a connected oriented Riemannian manifold of even dimension, larger than 4. So I'll denote the Hodge star operator by an asterisk with respect to the Riemannian metric. And I look at some vector bundle over this manifold with a connection whose curvature I'm going to call F. So in this very general setting, if I have a closed 2D minus 4 form that I call sigma, I can write down a generalization of the usual self-duality equations in 4 dimensions. And these are called the sigma self-duality equations, which are written in blue there. So sigma is a closed form. There's a holonomy group that's a symmetry group of these equations. So that's some subgroup of the structure group of the frame bundle of your manifold, which is broken by these equations. And so these are instanton equations. So if since sigma's closed, you can show that they have a topological nature. So they're labeled by some topological number that you call the instanton number. And moreover, any solution to the sigma self-duality equations also solves the Yang-Mills equations. It just follows using the fact that sigma's closed, and then the usual Bianchi identity for the connection. Okay, so these are first-order equations that yield solutions for the second-order Yang-Mills equations in any even dimension. So what we'll do is we'll actually complexify. So we'll assume that MD admits an integrable complex structure. So we'll turn this Riemannian manifold actually into a Kähler manifold with Kähler form omega. And that'll, of course, further reduce your holonomy to the subgroup of the D by D unitary group. Then under suitable conditions, which I'll mention a little bit about in my next slide, these sigma self-duality equations with solutions of the sigma self-duality equations with trivial first Chern class are equivalent to some complex equations called the Donaldson-Uhlenbeck-Yau equations. So here the F with superscripts is just a decomposition of the two-form curvature into 2-0, 1-1, and 0-2 types with respect to the given complex structure. Okay, so these are equations that describe stable holomorphic vector bundles over your Kähler D-fold with finite characteristic classes. Okay, the first equation just tells you that the bundle is holomorphic. Okay, so if we go and look at the various dimensions now. So D equals 2, this is a four-dimensional manifold. Sigma is a function, and it's closed, so it's a locally constant function. And so the instanton equation reduces like that. You use the square property of the Hodge star operator. And that tells you that sigma has to be plus or minus 1. And the plus minus 1 corresponds to whether you look at the self-duality or anti-self-duality equations. The holonomy group is SO4, and if you introduce the complex structure, the holonomy is reduced to U2. So if we go down a dimension, down to 2 dimensions, So we want to look at, if we take the dimensional reduction of the anti-self duality equations over a two-sphere in a certain way, a certain type of dimensional reduction, then we get the vortex equations, equations in a Yang-Mills Hicks theory for a connection and a section on a two-dimensional map, surface, complex surface, where the homonymy is U of 1. So three dimensions, well, we just, the sigma has to be a two form, so we can just take sigma to be the Kähler form of the threefold. And we'll assume that the holonomy group is SU3 in this talk. It could be U3, but we'll assume it's SU3. And now D equals 4. Okay, so D equals 4. Okay, so sigma now is a 4 form. Okay, and it's a 4 form which defines something called a spin 7 structure on your 8-dimensional manifold. And this operator here, where you take a form, wedge it with sigma, and then act with the Hodge duality operator, it acts on two forms. So it takes a two form into a two form, it's self-adjoint, and it has eigenvalues -3 and 1. So we look at the case where the eigenvalues are 1 when we think about the self-duality equations. So now when you introduce a complex structure, this breaks the spin 7 holonomy down to SU4, where the SU4 structure is given by some holomorphic 4 form on M4, and the compatible spin 7 structure given by this formula. So omega is the SU4 structure, and little omega is the original Kähler form. Then the spin 7 instanton equation, which looks like this, reduces in this complex setting to this pair of equations, which look very much like the Donaldson-Uhlenbeck-Yau equations, except that there is a minus subscript here. And the minus means that what you have induced by the usual Hochstar operator, complex conjugation in this holomorphic 4 form, there's an antilinear involution on the space of 2 forms, on the space of 0, 2 forms. So it squares to 1, and this lives in the minus 1 eigenspace. And the important thing here in this splitting is that this star omega, it's an involution, right? So it's square, really squares to 1, and it's the splitting into plus or minus 1 eigenspaces is a real splitting. Okay, so there's this kind of underlying real structure that's sitting there in 8 dimensions. Okay, so when we start thinking about these instantons in various dimensions, you can see already that things different things happen depending on what dimension you are. And in particular, when we get up to the 8-dimensional case, the case of 4 folds, something special happens there. Yes, Kevin?
Do these equations, are they described by stable holomorphic bundles or something?
These ones, the one with the minus. I don't know. Yeah, with the minus there, I don't know what that means. I mean, it's not that, you see, as I said, this is really a real splitting.
I was wondering if there's a Donaldson-Uhlenbeck-Yau type
theory. Pardon me?
I was wondering if there's a Donaldson-Uhlenbeck-Yau type.
Yeah, no, I know what you're asking. Yeah, okay. But I don't know, how to interpret the version of holomorphic here. You see, because as I said, this is a real splitting, so it's not like the usual complex splitting you have. So I don't know. Okay, so that's the story about the instanton equations. Okay, are there any other questions? Okay, so that was to tell you what we mean by these generalized instantons. So now we come to the key sort of geometric player that we want to think. Well, we can now use these equations to give a general geometric setting for the combinatorial problem we talked about earlier. So we're interested in this thing called the instanton moduli space. So we want solutions of the sigma self duality equations with a fixed instanton number, modulo gauge transformations, or gauge symmetries. And the rest of this talk, I'm only going to talk about this moduli space in the simplest case, where MD is just a d-dimensional complex space, and in rank 1. Now in rank 1, when I'm talking about instanton solutions here, I really mean I want non-singular solutions. There'll be lots of solutions that are singular. And in rank 1, there are simply no non-singular solutions. We have to define what we mean by this by solutions here. And one way to understand that is to go to the think of the solutions here in terms of non-commutative gauge theory. So particular non-commutative deformation of your theory. So there's a natural Poisson bivector, or rather family of Poisson bivectors I can introduce in the problem using the inverse of the Kähler form and just some positive number. And then you could take the usual complex coordinates on CD and you can quantize this Poisson structure. If you use something like Berezin-Toeplitz quantization, which is a type of geometric quantization tailored to this complex setting, this will give you operators which satisfy this kind of higher dimensional Weyl type algebra. And we'll represent these on a Fock module, the usual Fock module. So these Z's and Z bars, if you're a physicist, you think of these as creation annihilation operators. And so you can form a Fock space using those operators. And it's the unique up to equivalence, irreducible representation of that algebra. And once you do that, if you use the Siegel-Bargmann representation of these, of this algebra, then you can translate the instanton equations, which are first-order partial differential equations, into purely algebraic relations. So there are these operators now on H that satisfy these equations. And these operators, roughly, you want to think of as the actual connections. Okay, so they're the covariant derivatives. So if you take a commutator of two of these Z's, okay, they're the complex versions of the covariant derivatives. You take a commutator, this is the same thing as looking at the 0-2 component of the curvature in the complex parametrization. And if you take this commutator here between a Z and a Z dagger, that gives you the 1-1 component. So this point of view is very useful because these equations in this setting are much easier to analyze than the original partial differential equations, and in fact they can be solved explicitly. Okay, I'm not going to write down the solutions, but they can be solved. Okay, so there are these two points of view on how to think about these instanton equations. There's one in terms of just ordinary geometry. There's another one in terms of non-commutative geometry. A third way that comes from either of those two points of view is to look at a generalized ADHM parametrization of this moduli space. Okay, so this moduli space is the same thing as looking at a set of D n by n matrices, complex valued n by n matrices, together with a complex n dimensional vector, which satisfy those equations. So you have the matrices commute among themselves, and then there's some type of non-holomorphic equation that I wrote like this. So there's that R that appeared from the non-commutative deformation. Okay, and now you take the quotient of that space by the action of the n by n unitary group, which is defined by that formula there. Okay, so those are the three perspectives on the instanton moduli space. Now, geometrically, it's clear in this representation that this moduli space is isomorphic to something called the Hilbert scheme of n points in CD. Okay, and again, from a formulating that in an algebraic framework means you take the polynomial ring in these d variables z, and you look at the ideals inside there of codimension n. And that's actually, if you understand how to solve these non-commutative instanton equations, it's quite easy to see how these come about, because you can write down families of solutions of those equations, which are parametrized by partial isometries that are in correspondence with these ideals inside and give you these infinite dimensional subspaces of your Fock space.
Does this apply even in the spin 7 case?
I'm sweeping a couple of things under the rug here. It's correct that I shouldn't, so let me just explain that, because that is a little bit of a subtlety. In the spin 7 case, if I look at the non-commutative instanton, the equations, what I should write down is something like this. Okay, this would be the condition that f minus 0, 2 is 0. And then the condition that bi and bj commute should be replaced by a similar condition. Okay, so I shouldn't say that they commute from the onset, but rather satisfy this equation. However, using the second equation there, that second equation still holds, you can show that this equation is equivalent to the equation BIBJ equals 0. Okay, so that's, just to streamline a bit, I skipped this step. And indeed, from the perspective of Hilbert schemes, if you're an algebraic geometer, you'll like this perspective where you have the commuting matrices plus a stability condition. That's what the second equation does there. From a physics point of view, it is really more natural to think about this equation, and particularly because it naturally comes with the real structure. And that's what you actually use in practice in the physics calculus. Okay, so now I call these moduli spaces, they're not smooth in general. So the generic dimension is the dimension of your complex space, CD, times the instanton number. But there's typically an obstruction vector space over each point, which means a tangent bundle. Well, you can have a tangent space over each point. The tangent space does not vary smoothly long. It can jump in dimension. So there's a well-known obstruction theory to deal with this. So there might not be a well-defined tangent bundle, but using the instanton deformation complex, there's a well-defined virtual tangent bundle, which is this two-term complex, where TM is the usual would-be tangent bundle and OB is the obstruction bundle. And you can write this down fairly explicitly what this operator D is in the complex. It follows from the deformation complex for your instanton equations, and this is just the linearization of those equations, and then followed by the projection onto the projection onto the subspace orthogonal to the gauge orbit. I'm going to let you think of it almost like a normal bundle to the actual tangent bundle. So that complex, we can talk about the rank now of this bundle formally. So it's that'll define the virtual dimension of my moduli space as the difference in the ranks between each of these. And that turns out to be well-defined. In this case, it's constant. So it's or equivalently, it's the index of this operator that appears there. And then we'll call the Euler class of this virtual bundle just the difference, the quotient of the Euler class of the would-be tangent bundle by the obstruction bundle. Okay, so you're given you have your moduli space in a particular dimension D, and now we'll choose some vector bundle whose rank is equal to the virtual dimension. And that's what's going to set up the problem for the what I call the generalized instanton partition functions. Okay, so we'll write down some geometric partition functions that will be equivalent to the combinatorial partition functions we wrote down. And these will compute the intersection theory of my moduli space. Okay, so I weight the instanton numbers. Again, I count all the instanton numbers at once. And for each n, I take the Euler class of this bundle I just introduced that has rank equal to this virtual dimension, and I formally integrate it. That's very schematic, and it's not really defined, but what we do, and this is following Nekrasov's approach to doing the instanton counting by introducing a omega background. The omega background here just means we're going to think of everything here equivariantly. Okay, so there's a natural torus group sitting inside the holonomy group, which acts on the ADHM data like that. So I'll write the infinitesimal generators by these epsilons. And it's a fact, just going and looking at the instanton, the ADHM parametrization of the instanton equations, that the torus fixed points of the moduli space correspond to monomial ideals inside the Hilbert scheme. And so ideals that are generated by monomials. And when D is greater than or equal than 2, these monomial ideals are in one-to-one correspondence with D-dimensional Young diagrams. So this is where the connection comes to the counting problem. Okay, so you have this torus action, and now you can go and apply a virtual localization theorem in equivariant cohomology, which reads like this. So now the integrals you have become a sum over fixed points. The fixed points are isolated. That's the original class that you were integrating, and then the virtual localization theorem would divide this by the Euler class of the virtual tangent bundle. And I told you how to write that in terms of the original tangent bundle and obstructions. So this is the object now we want to compute. Okay, and I haven't told you any of the technical details. The fact is, though, that these sum ends here are computable in physics. They're in many ways. You take your field theory and you're calculating these as fluctuations about the classical solutions. And there are many ways to do that calculation. You can do it, for instance, in the non-commutative gauge theory. You can do it by writing down a matrix model for your ADHM parametrization. Or simply by just looking at characters of the instanton deformation complex. So I won't go through the calculations of those, but they're computable. Okay, so let me just now run through the different dimensions. Okay, so going back to D equals 1. Okay, these were vortices. The counting function is for vortices in two dimensions. And here things are nice because Mn1 is a smooth manifold. It has dimension n. And it's just a simple property of the Hilbert scheme of n points on the complex plane, sorry, complex line, which is the same as c to the n. So it's smooth. There are no obstructions. The obstruction bundle is trivial. And so for this bundle that has the same rank as the dimension of n, the natural thing to take is just the tangent bundle. So the quantities I'm going to be computing are the Euler characteristics of these moduli spaces. So now you look at the fixed points, the equations for the fixed points. And they look like this with the torus action I wrote down. This is a one-dimensional torus now, a circle. And the torus fixed points look like this, right? So I need to find a g of t which satisfies this equation for each t. And the fact is there's a unique solution, unique fixed point that satisfies the second set of instant ADHM equations. It's fairly easy to write down what that solution is. So up to symmetry, up to U of n symmetry, there's a unique fixed point. So if you look at the formula I wrote down before, what you get is the sum at each fixed point of the Euler class of the tangent bundle divided by the same Euler class. So they cancel. There's only one fixed point for each end, so you get this simple sum, which is the original geometric series we wrote down. Okay, so in this language, G1 that we thought about from a combinatorial problem is simply the generating function for Euler characteristics of vortex moduli spaces. Okay, D equals 2, so these are the usual instantons. And again, things are nice here because the moduli space is smooth. It has dimension n, so the obstruction bundle is trivial. And again, we just take the bundle to be the tangent bundle. The fixed points now are monomial ideals of codimension n inside this polynomial ring into variables. And they correspond to partitions, ordinary partitions of size n. And the correspondence goes like this. So if you have an ideal labeled by a partition lambda, then it's generated by this combination of monomials. Okay, so it's a similar story as before. There are no obstructions. The Euler class we're integrating is the Euler class of the tangent bundle, so it cancels in the localization formula. So when you sum over fixed points, you just sum over 1, very easy. And so these two things together is exactly this Euler function that I wrote down before. Okay, so Euler's function is the generating function for the Euler characteristics of instanton moduli spaces, or equivalently the Hilbert schemes of n points on the plane. Okay, so next we go to d equals 3. So this is the case of 6 dimensions or threefolds. And now things start to get complicated. So it's the first instance where things aren't smooth. So the instanton moduli space in this case are equivalently the Hilbert scheme. Is not smooth. It's really a scheme. And it just thought it has branches that have varying dimension. But the virtual dimension is 0. The virtual dimension is 0. So, introducing a bundle of rank 0 and integrating its Euler class means I should just integrate 1. Okay, so I'm computing some kind of a volume of this moduli space. So again, the the torus fixed points in this case, again, correspond to monomial ideals inside this polynomial ring on three variables of codimension n, and those correspond to plane partitions of size n. Now, in this case, you really have a non-trivial obstruction bundle, and the Euler classes of the obstruction bundle and tangent bundle in general are not equal. They're quite complicated. But the simplification is that if you look at them at a fixed point, at a torus fixed point, they're equal up to a sign. Sign given by the number of boxes in your plane partition. So it's similar to what we had before. You have the you're integrating one. Now the Euler class of the obstruction bundle is the same as the tangent bundle up to this sign. So the Euler classes cancel up to a sign in the formula. So you get a formula like this. And that's simply the generating function we had before, except I put in the argument as minus. Okay, so this McMahon function that we had before is the generating function for what's called the Donaldson-Thomas invariants of C3, okay, which are counts of the virtual numbers of ideal sheaves on C3. Okay, so everything here is well understood and relatively simple. So let's come to the D equals 4 case now, where the combinatorial problem wasn't understood. Again, the Hilbert scheme in this case is again really a scheme. It's not smooth, and now it has a positive virtual dimension. Virtual dimension is n. It has obstructions, so I don't have a well-defined tangent bundle, but there's another natural bundle of rank n that I can introduce. It's sometimes called a tautological bundle over the moduli space. So I simply take the data defining the ADHM equations, and I take this fibered product with Cn, okay, where un acts on the ADHM equations as written before, and on Cn in the fundamental representation. It's a bundle of rank n. And because of this extra fiber on C to the n, there's a scaling symmetry on the fibers that gives you an extra circle action, U of one action, and we'll call the parameter of that action m. Fixed points, again, are analogous. The fixed points correspond to these solid partitions now of size n. And now the instanton partition function looks like this. Okay, so here's the usual combination from the virtual localization formula. And now here's this Euler class where I extend the torus action to include this extra fiber scaling here, evaluated at each fixed point parametrized by a solid partition. And I'll write a formula on the next slide for it, but it doesn't simplify. It doesn't simplify like in the other cases. And one of the difficulties in this case comes with the fact that there are sign choices to make. So as I said, these equations that I write down here are naturally have a real structure to them. Okay. And that's reflected in these obstructions. So the obstruction bundle is actually a real vector bundle. So you want to define the Euler class of a real bundle. Okay. So what you do typically is you complexify the bundle where you can take the Euler class and then take the square root. But of course, the square root involves a choice of sign. Okay, so there's a choice of sign to make in the localization formula at each fixed point to compute the Euler class here. Okay, so given such a choice, you can write down a formula, compute the Euler classes explicitly, and you can write down the formula there. Okay, so it's some complicated combinatorial expression. It depends on these four equivariant parameters epsilon and then the new one that I called m. And the product there runs through the locations on a four-dimensional lattice of the corners of each of these four-dimensional Young diagrams that correspond to the solid partitions. So that's just some complicated thing. So what is that? And this was a remarkable thing. This was conjectured in a series of works, but in physics it was conjectured originally by Nekrasov and then generalized to the higher rank case and in the K-theory setting by Nekrasov and Piazzolunga, and an independent work by Kao and Kuhl in algebraic geometry. So they conjectured a closed form for this function. And this is now known. This was proven rigorously a few years ago by Kuhl and Renamo using the Donaldson-Thomas theory on C4. And a work that's still unpublished, but there's a circulating preprint where that. So it's a theorem now, what this form is. And the theorem says that there's a choice of these orientations such that that mess up there takes this simple form. So this isn't a typo. This is really a 3. That's the G3 was the generating function for plane partitions, not solid partitions. But now it's modified with this non-trivial exponential. So this was this measure that I alluded to before. Rather than using the simple measure, which is you only weight your count by q to the sigma, you use this modified measure and you get a formula, a closed formula that now seems to make more physical sense from the statistical mechanics. And using this measure, of course, it shows that somehow, because G3 is involved, that these solid partitions, when counted or probed in a certain way, really look to be three-dimensional rather than four-dimensional. So I'm done. And I just wanted to say that this is a way that say, physics and geometry have crept in to say something about a combinatorial problem. So it showed us why it's just not natural to do the sum only over these weights. And from that, we can get actually some closed expression for what's otherwise a very complicated looking combinatorial series. And there's various other things that people have done with this geometric formulation to say something about combinatorial problems now involving solid partitions. So our understanding of the combinatorics of solid partitions is now improving due to this advances in these geometric perspectives. And that's it. Thanks.
If there are any questions for you?
Is there a way to extract the traditional counting function of solid partitions from this? Is there like some limit in which the extra?
It doesn't seem to be, no. No. I mean, Nekrasov mentions this in his paper that he did some numerical work trying to find some limit, right, that you can take, and it doesn't look like it. It doesn't, I mean, we haven't solved this doesn't solve the original problem of writing down what G4 is, right, the generating function. But it somehow tells you why that problem looked complicated, and you know you have this non-trivial modification. Then you get a closed form, but no, that's still open.
So when you say the original thing, do you mean the one that was wrong?
Yeah. So I wrote down the thing.
In
order six. Yeah. Yeah. So we still don't know. We don't have a closed formula for that. Yeah.
The thing that was wrong was a conjectured formula for G4. But
yeah.
Is it G4?
Yeah. It's just a.
It just doesn't match up.
Yeah.
So if I didn't know anything about geometry, would this measure on partitions be a natural thing?
Nekrasov talks about this in his paper. In fact, he introduces the measure first as some kind of statistical, in some kind of statistical mechanical framework, and does it all before going to the geometrical setup. And he somehow argues that this is I'm not sure, I don't understand the argument, to be honest, but his perspective is that this is a natural measure to introduce. And in fact, his paper is called Magnificent Four, and he says the Magnificent Four means that he doesn't think you can go higher than this. So if you could ask the next question, is there something in for d equals 5? Certainly from the string theory perspective, no. Even geometrically, I'm not sure if the instantons in 10 dimensions have any special structure.
Any questions? Let's thank Richard again.